Hi, my name is Andrew Pontius.
And I'm Will French.
And this is Edge Cases, a show about mostly Apple-related software development and Scott Pilgrim fan appreciation. This is episode 11. We're recording on Saturday, July 28th, 2012. What's our topic today, Wolf?
Pop software and the App Store.
Okay. So I don't necessarily have anything to talk about. Before we get started, anything from you, Wolf?
Not too much, so I think we can just get right into it.
Wow, shortest prelude ever, but that's fine. Take it away.
Okay, so the obvious topic is to talk about 10.8, which came out with our alternate schedules. I'm the guy who got lucky this is the first show after 10.8 shipped. But, you know, I read the Syracuse article. I even listened to the 2-hour-plus Syracuse 5x5 podcast, Hypercritical podcast.
Well, I haven't gotten to that yet.
Yeah, I digested it. And, you know, 10.8 is just kind of boring. Except for Gatekeeper, High DPI, and SceneKit, it's pretty boring. So I couldn't muster enough energy to actually talk about it. So I'm glad Syracuse puts in the time to write all this stuff out, because he obviously has some sort of drive there that I lack, but I definitely could not have written that many words on 10.8.
Sure.
So have you upgraded yet?
I tried to upgrade when the GM came out, and then so I moved everything over to a new partition, but then my devices wouldn't sync properly.
I see.
And, you know, you get into various help forum things, and they, you know, they say, well, try this and try this and try this. And of course, you've already tried those things. And then the next thing they say is, well, okay, delete all your data and, you know, start fresh.
Yeah.
Like, no, I'm not going to delete all my data and start fresh. So that's where we're at. And since we found out that the build number for the one that got released is the same as GM, I know they didn't make any fixes.
Right.
So I'm going to wait until at least 10.8.1 for that. And that's what I did. Actually, Lion was the first time that I got to take my time with a release.
Oh, right, yeah.
Because it was the first time I wasn't at Apple, mm-hmm. And so I didn't have to deal with, at least after a point. I was actually at Apple during the beginning of the Lion release cycle, but after I, you know, wasn't working there anymore, I didn't have to install any buggy, you know, alpha builds and everything else, and, you know, all that stuff. So I think it was like a year. It was at least like months and months and months until I installed Line, and it was glorious to just not have to deal with the new OS bugs. And I was thinking this time around that since it did seem to be getting better reviews in terms of bugs, that I would install it right away, which I tried. But so I would have been able to live with just about everything except screwing up all the data on my iOS devices. And since it promised to do that, gonna wait. But so you've installed it already?
Yeah. I installed GoMaster pretty much as it came out, and for the developer builds, because I needed to play with the new accounts access API, whatever, and try out some theories about how it worked and what information can pull out of it as soon as possible. So I jumped right in on it. So yeah, I don't know if like most people know about like how like Apple. Like Apple employees, at least, you know, certain aspects of certain Apple employees, like, you know, when you're working on the next version of Mac OS X, like, there's like the build server and not the build server, but like the distribution server, and you're supposed to upgrade your operating system like every morning.
Pretty much.
It almost sounds suicidal, but, you know, that's kind of the name of the game. Like, this is the new version, and kind of Apple dog foods his own employees, and they get all the sharp thorns.
You have to deal with the bugs. One of the things that, again, part of the same joke that I was making before was that my impression of every OS build that's come out since I joined Apple was, my God, they're all just buggy pieces of garbage. They're slow. They've got all these problems. And, you know, a lot of times these things would only get fixed near the end of the cycle. Mm-hmm. So I just had this completely negative impression of all of our stuff.
Right.
You know, so it's kind of, you know, it's the way things go, but it's kind of a weird situation to be in as an employee.
Yeah, I don't know if it's really, you know, I understand the reasoning behind it. I don't know if it's a good policy. I mean, it seems to me if you have these guys you want to be productive, the last thing you want to do is feeding them alpha software all day.
That's yes. Those sorts of discussions were had at times in my presence.
Okay. That's probably enough to be said about that.
Yeah.
Okay, so eventually maybe we'll talk about, I mean, high DPI is kind of boring. Gatekeeper, technically.
We talked about it before.
Yeah, a little bit, I guess. Mm-hmm. And Gatekeeper technically isn't all that exciting. It's mostly from the political area. And so really technically the most thing I'm excited about is seeing Kit. But I don't see myself writing 3D software real soon. I don't know about you.
No, not so much.
So it's,
I mean, can you imagine? Like a couple of people, you know, I think Will Shipley, among others, has sung its praises. I think it was Will Shipley. But yeah, like, who would make regular software that is 3D? Like, I can imagine this being a real temptation for people to just write in some whiz-bangy thing on top of their software just to take advantage of it. Mm-hmm. But even then, like, that would be a lot to go through to add something like that.
Yeah.
So, but I'm curious to see what people do with it. But yeah, it's hard at the moment to think of a reason to do it. On the other hand, why would they have done it if it wasn't something that lots of people would need for one reason or another? Mm-hmm. Dunno.
Yeah, it's also surprising that, like, SceneKit makes its debut on the Mac. Like, it strikes me as, like, you know, this could be, you know, obviously iOS is huge for gaming, and you could almost say, hey, developers, this is a nice little, if you don't have the OpenGL chops, why don't you write your game to SceneKit? And, I mean, mm-hmm. SceneKit doesn't seem to me to be, you know, very performance-oriented, but it seems to have a much lower learning curve, less steep learning curve than OpenGL, and it also ties that game to iOS, so you can't easily port it, which is good for Apple.
Right, as opposed to OpenGL, certainly. Uh-huh. Yeah, I suppose the one interesting thing that occurred to me was how Core Animation also started on the Mac. Yes? Right.
But, if you look at the timeline, that kind of makes sense, because they obviously were working at iOS at the time, but they were kind of like parallel developing, you know, basically the iOS technologies on the Mac.
Yep.
Same thing with Dashboard.
Could be the same thing going on here. Who knows?
Could very well be.
Yeah.
I mean, really, and now the Mac is the smallest installed base, so if they want to kind of prototype a technology.
Try it out, right.
Right, just throw it to the Mac people.
The guinea pigs.
There you go.
Yeah, and then also, when there have been a couple of times, not every time, but a couple of times when Apple has introduced something where we all kind of scratch our heads a little about it, which was in some ways the case with Core Animation as well. Mm-hmm. We found out later that, you know, there was a bigger picture involved, and so I'm curious if there is a bigger picture that we just haven't been introduced to yet.
Sure, yeah. Okay, so since 10.8 is kind of a topic bust, instead I have there's been a few things. Did we mention the Sparrow acquisition at all last week?
We have not.
We didn't. Okay. I didn't think we did, but I didn't want to go through the effort of actually listening to the show.
All right.
But it's interesting that the entire Sparrow thing happened, and then Marco had a recent post about Mac App Store relevance. And I think there's a set of topics here that kind of intertwine. So I'm going to try to build a narrative out of these almost seemingly unrelated events. So Marco has had a post recently about how he calls it the Mac App Store relevance. And the choice quote from it is, I've lost all confidence that apps I buy in the App Store today will still be there next month or next year. The advantages of buying from the App Store are mostly gone now. My confidence in the App Store as a customer has evaporated. And did you read that posting?
I did, and I did. I thought of you when I was reading it.
Yeah, you know, it's because this is basically a subpoint of my posting where I recommended buying direct.
Yep.
And it was, I think, it's like 0.5 or something. But so kind of my follow-up here is that my blog posting was kind of like focused on the sandbox. But it's not about the sandbox. Instead, it's Apple not caring about its customers and its third-party developer customers. So, I mean, basically...
Not caring about the ecosystem, it seems.
I wouldn't say... Yes, that's true. They don't care about the ecosystem, but they are actually... they're burning their customers. I mean, they're you know, when you buy through the App Store, you're buying a product through Apple, and they are burning those people. Really, sandboxing was an acid test that Apple failed, and because you know there are products out in the store, sandboxing drops, and there are products that literally could not be updated anymore because they ran afoul of the rules. So the only thing you could do there is to either leave it up forever and then it was more and more out of date, or try to migrate people to a direct sales model. But that totally falls on developers. And it's really something that the developer has to do on their own. And so it was you know, I couldn't believe that Apple would actually pull the trigger and basically invalidate software purchases for people who've spent money. And this kind of, you know, just adds onto the pile of the App Store problems where, you know, no trials, no refunds, and that if you want to upgrade your software to a version 2.0 and get paid for it, Apple's recommended and only course of action is to say, well, I mean, not only a course of action, but the recommended course of action is to say, okay, you know, you stop selling your 1.0 app and you create a new app that has no relation to the previous one and you sell that. That's what I think what Icon Factory had to do with Twitterific when they wanted to do, get upgrade revenue.
Yeah, a couple of high profile apps have done that,
right,
that I'm aware of.
And that's so customer burning. It's unbelievable.
It grieves so many. It's pretty bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's not really about sandboxing itself, which is interesting because, like, you know, sandboxing is actually a really cool technology, but the way in the politics about it and the App Store side of it is really made it clear about how the App Store, how Apple views its customers and how it's willing to just totally burn them. It's amazing. On the software side, they're willing to do this, but it's amazing on the hardware side. Like, the Genius stuff is amazing, and how well they support Mac people and iOS people. So it's like, it's almost like, you know, Jekyll and Hyde type thing.
Well, certainly one of the things that struck me when they first started the App Store was how so much of the infrastructure was adapted and modified from the iTunes Store.
Right.
So there was so much of the technology which seemed to be, you know, for music that mm-hmm. they repurposed, but then didn't really completely think through or test or whatever. And it really gave me the impression that they were very much under the gun about the success. They weren't necessarily expecting it to be as big a hit as it was, but they had to keep treading water to keep it going. And I get the feeling that it's been kind of like that from day one, that they've been riding this tiger and they've just never quite been able to catch up, never been able to think through things the way they normally would before a product gets released. And it feels to me like a lot of these rough edges that they've never managed to sand off, or things that only get fixed years after they start showing up as problems. It just seems like a lot of it is this trouble with the initial setup that they've never had the ability to patch.
Yeah, I would imagine that probably the worst team to be on in terms of stress in Apple is the iTunes team.
Yeah.
Because, like, not only are you supporting Windows, you have this really old code base, and, like, on every, like, next thing Apple does, you have a deadline, right? They always have to add new crazy stuff to iTunes. And I think part of the problem with iTunes is that it's always on this relentless treadmill that they never get to regroup and kind of decide what the next step is, because they're always having to add the next thing that Apple wants to do, because iTunes has for some reason become the hub for everything.
Everything. Although there's a big difference between the app itself. I'm not disagreeing with you, but there's a difference between the app itself and, say, the App Store, which is primarily a web,
right,
a website, even if it's stuffed into, you know, iTunes itself. So I think they're different, but they're both under a lot of stress, right?
Sure.
I mean,
oh yeah,
the performance that needs to come out of the App Store is probably pretty incredible.
Yeah, and two other things along those lines that you know, you tend to look upon Apple as this, you know, hugely successful corporation, this monolith that can move mountains. But on the ground, it tends to be these small teams that are tend to be very resource constrained. And it's amazing they're able to do what they do, actually.
Yes. In fact, there was something recently on Twitter where people were saying, I think you actually, it's another one of these times when I quote the Wolf tweets, which the Wolf tweets, that could be a book, where you said something like, oh, Apple is obviously showing that it's deprecating multiple monitors.
Mm-hmm, right.
And somebody came back and said, no, that's obviously not true. You know, I work at Apple, that's not true. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, they said it in such a way that it wasn't quite, you know, an official statement, but it was somebody saying, no, that's not true. And it got into a little conversation where somebody eventually said, yeah, the team, you know, I was on the team that did that or whatever, and we just didn't have the resources for it. And somebody else said exactly that. Hey, you know, you're this part of this giant company that has all this money, you know, if you couldn't do it, you know, obviously that must have been deliberate. Well, no, not deliberate. It's just the way they work, and they can't change their modus operandi for every special case, for every edge case, or they'll never be able to have a working system.
Right.
So lots of things fall prey to that. Of course, lots of things actually work out with that. They manage to put out a whole new OS in a year because they're part of this system where they don't have a huge amount of overhead. But there are going to be, the ramifications going to be the downsides of that as well.
Yeah, there seems to be, there must be a third way. Like, you have the Apple model where everyone's horribly resource constrained, but then you look at, like, the Microsoft model with this horrendously bloated middle management and where people have perhaps arguably too many resources. And, I mean, obviously, if you look at results, Apple seems to be doing better. But, like, either way, both ways seem pretty bad.
Well, I wonder, I mean, the other two giant companies that are doing pretty well right now, Facebook and Google, are they models that anyone could look at? Certainly, Google has the thing where you get to spend, 20% of your time on your own projects?
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that might be able to keep employees around and motivated. I don't know whether that's necessarily led to any new projects, skunkwork projects that have turned into big strategic successes for them. I think there have actually been a couple of big failures mm-hmm. when they tried to turn stuff into new products. I can't think of any right now, but there are a couple of times when they've released new products where people were kind of scratching their head saying, well, hey, why did you do that? Mm-hmm. And I think some of them might have come from those 20% projects. But yeah.
Yeah, going a little bit off topic here, but you know, I definitely know more about Apple's internals than I know about Google's internals. But mm-hmm. what strikes me is that there seems to be like a real caste system in Google. I mean, there is in every company, but there definitely seems to be kind of like the people who work on advertising, which is most people, and then there are people who get to do interesting work.
Yeah, it could be. And people have said that about Apple, too. I think a Syracuse episode at various points has talked about how with Apple getting big enough, there are too many divisions with competing profit motives.
Oh, right, yeah.
So is that slowing them down? That now they have to either placate a whole bunch of people or deliberately shut one of them down or stop one of them?
Right, the strategy tax.
Yeah, strategy tax. Mm. That was it.
Okay. Well, another thing I want to follow up on that you mentioned with the when you said how you know iTunes Store was built on music tracks and then they kind of just put software on top of it, and you know from that model totally makes sense the fact that you don't have trials because well you listen to a 30 second preview right? Mm-hmm. You don't have refunds because what you don't like that song anymore, come on, you should just buy it. It's 99 cents, blah, blah. And of course no upgrades, right? Do not upgrade your track, although I guess they do have the thing where you know you can get a higher bitrate version. So well, maybe that's what we should do. We should sell higher bitrate versions of our software.
high DPI, high bit.
Yeah.
Well, and they also have the thing now where you can complete an album, but that's new, mm-hmm. right? They didn't have that when they started. Again, it seems like they're adding to the base model now, mm-hmm. but they didn't make it that way at the beginning.
Yeah. Okay. So getting back on track here with the Mac App Store relevance, Nevin uh-huh. Morgan had a good article on blog posting about this, and the quote here is, put the two facts together, loss of casual users to iOS and the loss of non-casual users on the App Store, and it starts to look like a problem. And he's kind of pointing out that With the sandboxing and the App Store policy changes on the Mac side, is driving out kind of the non-casual software out of the Mac App Store. And iOS is sucking away all the casual users. So what's left is that if you want more and more, it's becoming that if you want non-casual software, the Mac App Store is not your solution. And unfortunately, the Mac App Store is the one that's been christened and blessed by Apple. And so it's actually weakening the indie software story, the direct software story, even when we need it perhaps most of all.
Sure. And I think I read that. Because you're saying basically you almost have nothing left in the Mac App Store?
Oh, I mean, it's there are forces at work, and we're not there yet. Mm-hmm. And it's not like it couldn't get better, yeah. Maybe. But yeah, these are the kind of the dynamics at play.
Well, and the idea for me was, I mean, a lot of people worried about this, that the Mac App Store would become the same sort of low price, casual, you know, game or software right. market that the iOS store was. And there was some discussion, I have no idea, but there was some discussion, well, that must be what Apple wants because they're setting up the same system in both places. Uh-huh. And so I don't know whether people have really been getting into it, the topic, but, you know, when they drive out the serious apps and they drive out the complex apps, the super duper, et cetera, is that just what they want? Do they just not care or even actively dislike those apps such that they really don't want most users to ever be installing them? And that would be, again, that would be bad for us, but does that really mean that they're not getting what they want? Are they going to think that's a problem?
Well, you just basically walked right into my next point, which is, so Joel Spolsky wrote in this very crappily named blog posting, Strategy Letter 5, but it actually is pretty good because it has a topic that here that I learned about for the first time through this blog posting, is about how smart companies try to commoditize their products' complements. And so Apple is definitely a hardware company, is a unique, and it's not Dust, obviously not Dust, some clone maker stamping out Windows PCs. I mean, it's obviously one of the great things about Apple is how well it integrates the hardware and software, and arguably, like, the software even drives the hardware. But obviously, Apple is making money by selling you atoms. And to that end, they want to lock you into their system, so you don't want to buy atoms from Samsung instead. So if they have these incompatible software systems that is iOS specific, you're much less likely to leave the plantation. Or maybe the VLAN? No, I think we'll go with the plantation. And so it is in Apple's interest to have a plethora of inexpensive software to kind of cover the entire ecosystem and to drive the price of software down, that everyone can buy iOS and Mac apps that run on iOS devices and Macs and not on their competitors' devices.
Right.
Okay. And so this kind of leads, and this is where we kind of have the jump, but I think I can tie it back in, about Sparrow being bought out by Google. Of course, you have, you know, the standard kind of outrage that that an indie company has been bought out. You have Matt Gemmell had a blog posting called Entitlement and Acquisition, where he kind of lays out rebuttals to a lot of the emotions and outrage that people feel. Uh-huh. So I'll link that up. But there's, I think, a couple more blog postings that kind of go into some interesting detail. And one is from Nili Patel. And I almost didn't read it because of the title, but the title is Apple help the best app developers not get acquired. So acquired is like acquired and hired and all in one word. And it's
yes.
It's pretty hard to pronounce, and I'm not a fan of it, but oh well.
Right.
But his main point is that he feels that Sparrow had to sell out because they weren't making enough money. So they have a team of five guys or whatever, they have VC, whatever. And the App Store wasn't delivering enough money to actually fund that model, so they had to sell out.
Right.
And he gave a couple of suggestions here about how this could be it could help developers stay independent. And his first suggestion was allow developers to charge a monthly or annual subscription pricing for their software. So right now, if you want to do a subscription software pricing, you basically have to have a backend service of some sort. You have to have a internet service. So I think in the App Store guidelines, like Apple calls out, like if you have a dating site, you can have people pay $30 a month, and then you could have a quote unquote free app for that. But that's your revenue model there. But if you have an app, then you can't say, oh, this app is $1 per month.
Right.
You just can say, oh, this app is $1, and now you own it, and you get free upgrades for life. His second point is allow developers to track the success of social and internet ad campaigns. And that's pretty obvious, too, that basically the App Store is this the singularity horizon or whatever in black holes, where it's like there's the point where light can't escape. This is black hole.
Event horizon.
Event horizon, that's what I'm thinking about. And so you can track people, pretty well up until you get to the App Store, but after that there's no way to pass tokens through and there's no way to actually figure out what works and what doesn't in terms of marketing yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like this is almost an extension of Apple's reflexive refusal to provide any information to outsiders.
Right.
Even though it's a completely different realm that they're involved in now. But yeah, go on.
Right. And yet, I'm sure Apple makes great use of marketing intelligence, but they just don't want to pass on to their third-party developers.
Yeah.
But. So this other fellow, whose name I'm sure I'm going to butcher, but I'll try, is Ryan Van Der Murray. But anyway, the title is "The Reason We're Upset About Sparrow's Acquisition." And a couple of quotes here from it is, the real issue is much deeper than this specific acquisition. The real issue is the sudden vulnerability we feel now that one of our theories about independent application development has failed. It's about the loss of faith in the philosophy that we thought was a sustainable way to ensure a healthy future for independent software development where most innovation happens. So his point is that we have the common refrain that if you're not buying the product, you are the product. And so we have this idea that people can sell software for more than at a price that allows them to work on it, and that's so much better than advertising or trying to monetize your user base and stuff like that. And basically, with Sparrow kind of getting acquired and wasn't able to be sustained, that it's kind of a blow to the idea of the independent application model. The independent application developer model.
Right, there was the Marco Arment post where he talked about where he posted somewhere else, hey, here's what my business model is. My business model is, charge a price that's more than my costs and make money that way. That's not what he said, but it's a paraphrase. And that was probably what a lot of us were thinking. Well, anyone who charges any price, if they're successful enough, will be able to make enough money to keep going based just on that income.
Right. Pretty much by everyone's measure, Sparrow seemed like a very successful app. So the question is, why weren't they able to maintain their independence? Some people blame VC, but maybe that wasn't the root cause. Maybe this model is failing in the general case.
Well, and it only cost what, like $3, right? Something like that.
$3 on the maybe iOS store. I mean, I think it was more on the Mac App Store.
Mm-hmm.
Like maybe $9.
Right, exactly. And so I don't know if people have really talked about, well, if they had raised their price on the iOS store, would that have helped? We can't know, but I think it's an interesting thing to think about.
Yeah. So this led to tangentially was a couple of tweets I caught from Buzz Anderson, and they were kind of discussing this kind of sustainability of Sparrow and so forth.
Yep.
And he has a couple of tweets here where he said, the lack of paid upgrades is probably part of the problem, but I don't think it's all of it. And another tweet says, I still think there's a cultural trend at work here that transcends mundane App Store mechanics. And he ends up pointing to Guy English's blog posting entitled Software Sea Change, but which probably would have gone by the more catchier title, Pop Software. And guy kind of points out that we have basically software has never been more successful. We have more people downloading and using software than we ever had before. And if you look at what need to be done there, it's like, it seems to be like no coincidence that we don't call it software, we don't call it programs, we don't even call it applications. We call it apps, because apps are non-threatening. They're just something you go out and get. They're fun. They're entertainment. They're these bite-sized pieces of entertainment. And because they're entertainment, the dynamics of the entertainment industry actually applies to software now. So, for example, pop software is hit-driven. So most people don't make any money, but a few totally win the lottery. That applies well. The social aspects of recommendation type stuff, viral, that helps drive hits. And so it makes me think about, there's kind of like now a division of software that I think we're still getting comfortable with, and versus the pop software and the non-pop software. And so the Mac side of things tend to be non-hits, non-pop software, tends to be productivity software, tends to be kind of the old school. And iOS side of things tends to be the pop software. And I think it's, obviously there's more money in pop software, but obviously it's hit-driven. And so it's kind of easier to like kind of say, well, Apple was doing this because of they want to commoditize their product's complements. And so that's an obvious dynamic at force here, why they want to do this. But I think I agree with Buzz that this is, like, if Apple didn't do it, someone else would. And there is a cultural trend here as software becomes more popular that all the entertainment industry effects come into play. And I think we're still trying to figure out what the dynamics are. For example, if you look at Mac sales, like Apple's selling 15.8 million Macs per year on average. I mean, that is, if they were selling that many Macs 10 years ago, 15 years ago, we'd be ecstatic. We couldn't believe what a great platform we have. But now that Mac has been overshadowed in terms of units sold by iPads and iPhones, you're not hearing so much about the Mac anymore, even though it's actually doing better than it was in the past. And so obviously the big money, the hit money, the gold record money is in the having hit app on the iOS side. And of course, gold rush mentality and winning the lottery mentality applies there. So it gets all the mind share when actually having a Mac app that's solid, that is not a piece of pop software, is actually, it's more possible to do that today, to go indie and support yourself on a Mac, writing Mac software, is better today than it has been in basically all of history. Well, history isn't that long, right? 1984.
Right.
And so a pretty good Mac app is totally enough to found a lifestyle business on. And I think that that this is overshadowed by the pop software phenomenon. But however, I think it also kind of leads to this fear where, because the Mac is kind of fading to the iPad, that if you just look at, when the iPad first came out, it basically matched the unit sales of the Macs and has been climbing ever since, explosive growth. So, and because there's only the App Store option on the iPad, and it seems like the Mac is doomed to have a falling trajectory. And as we know, Apple has no qualms about cutting things off that they do deem part of the past. So I think there's this fear that if you don't have pop software, if you actually want to build apps that get better version after version, and that aren't just a piece of entertainment, that this market, this window is closing. That's all that's left is the superficial.
Oh my God, this is the most depressing topic we've had yet.
And so it seems like the App Store encourages pop software. And I believe it does, but I don't think Apple's the sole culprit here. It does seem cultural. They just happen to have this exploding application platform. And it's obvious, by the way, they're doing things that they just don't care. I don't know if this, like, the small teams within Apple are just so overwhelmed with their success that they're doing everything they can just to stay above water, or if this is actually strategic. I mean, Apple's pretty good at keeping the cards closer to their chest.
Or a combination of both.
Sure.
Both factors involved. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I see really two ways out of this, and I'll just... And the first one I don't think actually works, which is kind of the advertising angle. Like, so I go basically back to Natalie Patel's argument that there needs to be a way for developers to make more money or to sustain themselves, to be independent, so that we can have non-pop software. So I don't know, flat software?
Pull software.
Oh, pull?
Push. Pop push,
oh,
push
I,
software.
Oh, I see. Push software. Okay. That sounds really bad. That's really
doesn't
confusing.
Really work, does it? No. Anyway.
Okay. So, well, the first one is obviously advertising, right? That you can put an ad banner in your app and then you try to make money off your advertising sales. I kind of fear that this is the way forward, but no one likes it. But again, we talked about the cable TV model before. It's like, you know, everyone you talk to hates it, but it seems to be the way that things can actually work. So it's kind of like what people tell you they like versus what they actually do. The other way that I think is actually the potential way forward is, like Natalie Patel said, the application subscriptions, where you don't need to have this back-end service that instead of charging 99 cents for your app, end of story, those 99 cents prices become 99 cents per year or per month or per day. And obviously Apple already has subscription mechanisms in place, but they tend to be tied to magazines and online services and stuff like that. If you could actually turn those applications into where, I wouldn't say it's always going to be the common case, but if you could have it where the application, where it's much more common, where this a standalone application has a recurring price, this stops the dynamic where you have these apps that come out in the 1.0, they have that burst of sales, and then the sales run flat, and it's against the developer's interests to go back and enhance the software or even create a 2.0. If he goes to create a 2.0, then he's putting money into an app that he won't, because he can't charge upgrade revenue. That's just money that he'll never see. He'll never get any upgrade revenue for that.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And with the, I mean, if he does do the Twitterific strategy where he, you know, basically turns off the old version and switches to a 2.0, you raise the ire of your customer base. I think that's just a really good way to screw your customer base.
Well, and software as a service is not a new phenomenon. I think right. Microsoft was trying it with their own apps for a while. And so in some ways, this feels like an actually a quite old idea instead of a new idea.
Oh, absolutely. To me, it's more of, because I think we tend to think of software as a service in modern days as there's this website I go to, and because I use this website every day, I'll have to pay for it because it's kind of an internet-y thing. But I think right. we need to get more comfortable with this idea that yes, there's this program on your flash storage or on your hard drive or your SSD that you can use it for a certain amount of time and that for a certain amount of money. And even though it's not even connecting to a back end service or something that seems to cost ongoing fees, like this is actually the way forward. And arguably, if you look at upgrade revenues in when I go buy a copy of OmniGraffle. You know, I'm paying $100 every couple years, maybe, for the upgrades, and that's totally boils down to $50 a year. That boils down to a monthly rate. So, the entire thing where software is non-subscription based is actually seems to me an artifact of how software used to be distributed, with burning disks and I was going to say burning floppies, but I don't know, writing to floppies and putting in packages and storefronts and, the old yep. mechanism, right? But I think it's basically the time has come for to have application subscriptions that aren't actually even tied to these extra services. And unfortunately, this kind of hinges on Apple to do this, and they seem to have no interest in solving this problem. And Nevin Morgan also had another good post about the dynamics of Apple's pricing and how they he did back of the envelope calculations, and Apple could give away all its software for 100 years or something, and they wouldn't have any problems financially. And it's obvious that, you know, Apple doesn't need the software income, so they don't really care about the software story as much as they care about the hardware story. And I think we're kind of suffering for that.
Well, I actually think maybe, but on the other hand, Apple, especially on the Mac, Apple is already doing what you're saying they aren't encouraging in others. And I think so. There's two pieces I want to say to this. One is, you know, you're saying Apple needs to do this, and yet what I'm hearing from everyone else is Apple the expectations Apple is setting up, not even necessarily the mechanics, but the expectations in the users is people will update their software forever, which is not necessarily something that they needed to make their users think. They could have started out by saying, you know, yes, here are the apps that we're selling on the store, but yes, you will definitely have to pay to get another version with major features. If they had put in upgrade pricing the very first, then everyone who was just getting their mind around apps could have gotten their mind around that too. People aren't stupid. And then they would have said from now on, okay, yeah, it makes sense. You know, hey, it makes sense. Because we've all been saying, yes, it makes sense that you can't expect unlimited work from developers for nothing. Mm-hmm. But since they haven't done that, now we have to overcome the unthinking prejudices of millions and millions of users. But on the other hand, Apple itself can't do pop software. Their OS, they're still not giving away Mac OS for free. Are they? They're right. Giving iOS for free. Are they? Yes, they've been giving iOS for free. But not Mac OS. And when you think people are saying, oh, $20 for a new version of the OS, that's so low. Well, it's low, but it's also an upgrade price. Now, it's an entirely new version of the OS, sure. So someone could get a full OS for $20. Except they really can't, right? Because as far as most users are concerned, you can install Mountain Lion over nothing.
Right.
You need an old version of it. It is by definition an upgrade version of iOS, which means what you're actually paying is $50 for Mountain Lion, because you needed to pay $30 for Lion, and now you're paying $20 for Mountain Lion. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's Lions all the way down, right? Because you know, okay. And then Lion was also an upgrade OS. So then what you had to install that on Snow Leopard, and then blah blah. But, you know, somehow you could get started with your turtle, and then you put turtles on top of it.
The turtles morph into cats, okay.
furry turtles. but if they need to do it, why won't they let us do it? Well, again, because it's a different story to set up the resources for external customers to do what internally they do. But I also think, and we've talked about this before, the idea that their major versions of software are exactly upgrade software. They're exactly substantial pieces of software. And didn't they do this? Did they do this with I think we've had this conversation a couple of times and I've never looked it up. Wasn't Aperture, didn't they give out several versions of Aperture where you know, the version one, which was one version of the app, and version two was a separate version of the app that you had to pay separately for, even for the iOS version? That's my impression.
Yeah, you mentioned this before. Yeah, I didn't look it up.
And
either.
We still don't look at it. Right, someday we're going to look this up. But it's exactly right that they need to pour resources into this stuff. And if the way they get around it is by saying, well, we're going to subsidize it by all of our other income and, you know, make these things which are not free simply because we can, and it's easier for us to do that. Well, okay, fine, you can do that. But the fact is, most of the software that they sell is substantial enough. It's not pop software that, you know, I've been hoping and thinking that they would introduce upgrades revenue simply for the sake of their own software. Mm-hmm. You know, and even if they haven't yet, even if they don't need to, well, they could use their own software as the guinea pig for this sort of thing, and then everyone would be happier. So it really is this weird thing where it would seem to be in their interest for any number of reasons, both for their own internal software, for their own publicly released software, for their own OS, for them to get this and do this right. But they're just not. Mm-hmm. And yeah, if they lose their best and brightest developers, don't. But then again, we come back to another thing, and I'll be finished in a minute. Don't worry, I won't ramble forever. But it seems like the way Apple changes, and we've been through this a couple of times, is when they're threatened by someone who can take away their business if they don't do the right thing. And the trouble here is that no one else is going to threaten their business in this fashion. Android is even worse. You know, there, you just can't make money off of Android software. It seems, now I'm sure there are some exceptions, but it seems like Android software primarily relies on ad revenue. You know, so why would Apple need to get the other model right when, you know, if you said, well, I don't want to rely on ad revenue, I'll go to Android. Well, no, you won't. Mm-hmm. So again, one reason that I am less than sanguine about this, why I'm less than optimistic about this, because there doesn't seem to be any external reason for them, any external competitor that is pushing them to do this better. And if they just drive most software companies out of business, they won't. It seems like they might not even notice for a long time,
right?
Because there will still be some.
There will still be the Pop Software, and Pop Software has a mindshare.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing is, you were talking about advertising. The other way to go is in-app purchases.
Good point.
Which is how a lot of games make their money. Mm-hmm. So that's the other way that software companies can make their money in the current model. So that's what I got.
Yeah. So I would say that actually, obviously, more people are having, you know, computers than one way or another than any other time in history. And we're only going to get more of those. So in that way, like, non-pop software has a great future, because there's so many people that, yes, people are going to have 500 pop apps, but they'll have they'll eventually have to get some work done, and they'll have a few non-pop apps. And so it seems to me like it really has a great future, but there's this software sea change, as a guy puts it, and unfortunately the way forward, like it's the way forward about how to do this is really what's up for grabs. The only mechanism that's really obvious and in place right now is advertising, and we all know the problems with advertising. So really what we're looking for here is a subscription model, which I think is really the best model going forward, but of course isn't directly supported the way I would like to see it supported, or talking about upgrades, either the half-assed way where you kill your product and you create a 2.0 product and leave people behind, or you do this, what you mentioned, the in-app upgrade, which I think there's a mental block for us developers because of the way we understand how software works. That, I mean, imagine if you roll a 1.0 of your software, you push it out of the App Store, now you go build your 2.0, right? And your 2.0 is a totally different product. You know, you rewrote the core, you rewrote the user interface, it's a different product. But basically, in order to fit it into the in-app purchase idea, you'd have to roll out a version of your 2.0 that basically looks and acts just like your 1.0, but then people could in-app purchase up to the 2.0. So basically now you're kind of like building this like fat binary kind deal where you have like two versions of your app in one, and you get to unlock the newer version. And this obviously this is not really how software works, and it's a hard mental model for us to grasp, even though the business model of it probably makes a lot more sense.
Right, and that brings up the case that's how Apple enforces things now, as far as I understand it, in that in-app purchase can't be something that you download that's new. It has to be something, it either has to be data, or it has to be something that unlocks code that was already there.
Right.
But it can't be, now I'm going to download some new code.
Right.
With that. And that's what, again, that's what you're saying, that's what makes it difficult. If you could have an in-app purchase, which is actually basically replace this app with your new app, mm-hmm. then we'd be golden. Right. But you can't. Yeah. So it really wasn't made to do that.
Yeah, the entire idea of like having large swaths of functionality you ship to your user, and that it's all disabled until you end up paying, you know, some money for it or more money for it, is kind of, it's not the type of way that developers tend to think. So it's an option that we don't immediately reach for. But unfortunately, it seems to like it might actually be the best option.
Yeah, I'd be curious. I would love to see someone try it. Of course, someone not me, some other guinea pig. But I'd love to, because maybe, you know, maybe there is some way to do it. Maybe, you know, yeah, I got nothing. I don't know how you do it.
Oh, well, you could literally ship two versions of your app, and like the new release is a 2.0 that the people have to buy.
Yeah, but how would that work? Like, you've got to have a signed binary, and you've got to have a single app.
It's a single app. You just put, you know, you have AP class 1, and you name all your classes like that, and then you come out with a version 2, AP class 2, And basically at launch, you look at whether you have the in-app purchase, and it's entirely different bloody app that launches depending on whether you have that, you know, all the classes are still there, and you know, VM will take care of the rest of not bringing the classes you don't use.
I mean, it almost makes it sound like an interesting technical challenge now.
You know what this reminds me of is, for some reason, it's like, do you remember Segments on the original Mac?
Segments.
I mean, I'm probably showing my age here, but it's very much strikes me as, like, in the old days, you were limited to your 32K code size segments.
Oh, right, yeah.
So, like, your app would launch, and, like, the core functionality of thus basically trying to figure out what next segment to load would be in the first segment, and then you'd, like, try to manage what other segment to jump to based on what menu command the user is selecting. Yeah.
Right.
But, yeah, it's very similar.
Yeah, it strikes me completely, again, off topic, sorry, but the idea that we're getting back to non-32-bit clean pointers.
Yeah.
Right, this idea with tag pointers, mm-hmm. that, you know, now we're using a couple bits that are unused for the space for pointers for do other neat things. But, you know, isn't that getting back to this day when, you know, a pointer wasn't really a pointer and you had to double check and everything? Mm-hmm. So old becomes new again.
Yeah. So that's my depressing topic.
Okay. Well, yeah, but it's funny though. I mean, we're still wrestling with how to deal with getting paid, making a good business model in the face of, you know, this system that isn't necessarily geared towards it. Mm-hmm. So,
I think the important thing is that to realize the takeaway here is this is the salad days for non-pop software. It's just getting lost in the noise.
It's true.
So that's an optimistic note there. It's just how do we get to the point where non-pop software can thrive? And I think that's the big question.
That's what we're working towards. Mm-hmm. Great.
Great.
All right. So if that's it.
That's it.
That's it. Okay. So if you want to send us some feedback, or see the show notes for the episode, or download other episodes, or sign up for us on iTunes, go to edgecasesshow.com, all one word. And you can also look us up on Twitter. My Twitter name is Apontius, APONTIOUS. And Wolf's Twitter is his last name, Wrench. That's the word rent, RENT, plus Z, plus SCH. So we'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.